Miami Beach is breaking up with spring break tourists. No, really.
Hey, we need to talk.
This isn't working anymore.
And it's not us, it's you.
Every March, American college students flock to Miami Beach for a weekend they won't remember. But after two deadly shootings last year, the city of Miami Beach has issued an official breakup video on its YouTube account.
Do you even remember what happened last March?
The city of Miami Beach declared a state of emergency over the weekend after a deadly start to spring break. Two fatal shootings and some out-of-control crowds also forced the city to impose overnight curfews.
So this year, people can expect bag checks, restricted beach access, DUI checkpoints, and $100 parking.
Maybe we can talk when you're done with your spring break phase, but until then.
Not to worry. There are other places you can go. From Virginia Humanities, this is With Good Reason. I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on the show, we're traveling, baby. First stop, Disney World. According to the Smithsonian, 80% of Americans have visited Disney World in Florida. That's more than the Grand Canyon, New York City, or the Smithsonian itself. Mark Williams is a professor of theater at the University of Mary Washington. He says Disney has both shaped the American identity and been shaped by it. Mark, you teach a course about the role Disney has played in constructing American identity. What do you mean by that? Has Disney World and Disneyland and Walt Disney done that, helped craft our identity?
Yeah, I think it has. You know, it's one of the things that my students and I talk about in the course is the ways in which Disney has shaped their own sense of who they are, their sense of what America is, what it means to be an American. And we talk about how those values are reflected in the stories that they've encountered, the films, you know, especially the animated features that they encountered as children. And of course, visiting the Disney parks as well, which many of my students have done.
Have most of them gone to Disney World or Disneyland in California?
Every now and then I'll meet a student who has been to Disneyland in California, but far and away, the parks in Florida are the ones that they know the best.
Your students are so young now. Do they know who Walt Disney was, the initial designer of all this?
They don't at all. We actually begin the course reading a little bit about Walt. You know, students have no idea, for example, that when the Walt Disney World Resort in Florida was built, Walt had already died. He never saw it.
Why do you say that Walt Disney's vision of the parks was built around his idea of America? Who was Walt Disney, and what was his idea of America?
You know, Walt was very patriotic, and he's an American success story, for sure. You know, he really came from a multi-generational family of failed farmers. He recognized himself as an innovator. He pursued this interest that he had in art and in animation in particular at a time when there wasn't really a field to enter. I mean, like, filmmaking was still relatively new. So he was really committed to it, and he made he hit it big. I took my students to the Smithsonian National Museum of American History for a Disney exhibit there that's really, really super. And we learned that 70 to 90% of Americans visit a Disney park at some point in their life. Mm. I mean, if you think about what that means, I think it signals that Disney is a cultural site. It's a pilgrimage site where Americans go. I mean, that number means that more Americans visit Disney than they do the Grand Canyon. You know, if you think about the places that, you know, that Americans experience, a common memory that Americans will be visiting Disney.
And what about once you go to the Magic Kingdom? What do you find that is quintessentially American and very deliberately so once you get there?
The first thing you'll encounter after you enter the gates is you're going to be in Main Street, USA. It's got it right there in the title. There's a flagpole with an American flag. There's an old train station right there. And it's the story of America at the turn of the last century. This is the time when Walt was growing up, 1890 to 1910. That's about our timeline. So I think we could also say this is a reflection of Walt's memory of his own childhood. Right. There's this Victorian style to the architecture. There's a barbershop quartet. There's a trolley. There's an old-time firehouse. There's a candy shop, right, where you can see the candies being made. And it's also a very nostalgic experience when you see them making the sweets. And you also smell sugar and vanilla and cinnamon, you know, when you are around that store. There's a hat shop, right, where you can get your mouse ears to wear those for the day. There's a jewelry shop. You know, so it's all commerce, right? It's telling the story of entrepreneurship, of these mom and pop shops that, you know, that used to line main streets all over America.
But, you know, then as part of the Magic Kingdom, there are also these other areas that aren't Main Street USA. There's Tomorrowland, Fantasyland. How do those also sort of build on this American identity or ideal?
Tomorrowland, you know, spoke to, I think, Walt's interest in progress, which I think that's an American ideal as well. You know, that optimistic spirit of, you know, there are brighter days ahead. And that world has a lot to do with innovation, with technology and transportation. The highlight attractions there is Space Mountain. It's a thrill ride. You know, it's a roller coaster that happens indoors. But it's the story of like traveling on a rocket ship. You know, of course, Walt Disney World in Florida was opened in 1971. So it's being constructed as we're making our way to the moon.
And then you have these other lands like Frontierland. And that's all about Western expansion. I guess that's eminently American, right?
Yeah, well, for sure. You know, Frontierland tells the story of the American West and the westward expansion, that idea of manifest destiny. And it really glamorizes that idea. And I think it tells the story that we would like to believe about our movement from the East Coast to the West Coast. You know, as you might expect in a theme park, Disney maybe glosses over some of the really harsh realities of what frontier life was like, but also what frontier expansion meant to native people who lived there. Like, that's not part of the story that Disney tells.
You've also said Frontierland is changing to try to tell more complete stories about more Americans. Tell me some of those changes in Disney's Frontierland.
Yeah, Walt wanted the parks to change. You know, he said is something along the lines of, you know, as long as there is imagination in the world, Disneyland will never be complete. And, you know, that spirit of change was part of the intention all along. But there's a particular attraction that is being changed right now as we speak, called Splash Mountain. And it draws from the story of the Song of the South, which is a film that is enormously troubling and has some really insensitive racial characterizations. But in 1991 or two, Disney put this attraction in with Zippity-Doo-Dah, the famous song Zippity-Doo-Dah, and it's a log flume ride and telling the story of Br'er Rabbit. And Disney has responded to, you know, to some pushback from guests over the years who started to question whether or not that story deserves a platform in Frontierland, in the Magic Kingdom. And so they announced their intention to change it. And so that is becoming Tiana's Bayou Adventure. So now it's going to tell a story about Tiana, who's the first African-American princess in the Disney princess canon. And so it's going to be fitting her story, which is really a New Orleans-based story, into that story of Frontierland.
There's some other changes that also reflect changing sensibilities. For instance, the Pirates of the Caribbean scene is changing. Is that part of Frontierland also?
No, that's in Adventureland. That has already changed. And one of the tableaus in this this attraction was a bridal auction, depicted humorously. You know, the pirates are violent in a funny way. It has a comic effect. And so making light of this bridal auction, you know, showing these pirates who have captured, you know, villagers and are auctioning off the women is something that guests maybe were finding less amusing than they used to. And so one of the brides being auctioned had this red hair and was really an iconic part of the ride. Well, now Red, her name is R-E-D-D Red, and she has now been made into a pirate. So there's no longer a bridal auction happening there, but now it's a scene of Red as one of the pirates, and she's strong and she's powerful. She has agency. So that's a new wrinkle on that story.
Part of what you have noticed and what you explore with students is that Disney reflected, you know, sort of the ideals of what he considered our American identity was, but also our identity continues to shape Disney as it changes, and Disney keeps shaping us in some ways. Do you think that's true? Do you think Disney is still shaping how we see ourselves?
I think it does in that I teach theater. That's my area. So story is what I think about. You know, I think that what any kind of story does is it invites audiences into a conversation about the world we share. And I think when we go to Disney or encounter a Disney film, we are sharing an experience of meaning making. And as long as Disney is telling stories that are directed toward, you know, American ideals, I think we're going to see ourselves reflected back in that.
How are you seeing these same kinds of things that are playing out in Disney reinventing itself happening in our backyards?
Well, yeah, so right here in Fredericksburg, just as I was moving here in 2020, there was an ongoing debate about a slave auction block that was still sitting in downtown, right on William Street, which is one of our main streets. And there's a plaque there that was contextualizing what that object was. But there was an ongoing debate about what do we do with the slave auction block? Do we leave it there as a visual reminder and contextualize it? Or is it too painful an object for it to have to gaze upon every day? And should it be placed somewhere else? Should it be in the local museum and contextualized there? It's just like the conversation about what do we do with Confederate monuments. And, you know, indeed, the slave auction block was moved to our museum. So there is still a marker downtown letting folks know what used to be on that corner of William Street. But I think that's identical to the conversation about what do we do with the bride auction scene? What do we do with Splash Mountain? I think it's the same conversation.
What was your own family's experience with Disney World and Disneyland? What do you remember, and how do your parents feel about it?
You know, I remember going to Disney World when I was little. I was 3 years old, and with my older brother and my family, and I just have these just a handful of scattered images of things that I remembered. And then I visited again with my family when I was maybe 13 or 14, and my younger brother, who had not been born when we took the first trip, it was his chance to go. And that was really special to experience those places with my family, to make those memories there with them. You know, I have that nostalgic feeling for Disney because of that. My parents have both passed away now. So it's a place that I remember fondly with them. And now I have my own children. And of course, I've wanted for them to have the same experiences and memories that I formed. So, of course, I have taken them to Disney World and wanted them to see and experience the same things that I experienced with my own parents.
Many, many times have you taken them?
Yes, many times. I didn't go many, many times when I was very young, but my parents eventually retired and had a home in Central Florida. So it was very near the Disney park. So I think it was bait for the grandchildren. You know, I think that they knew that if they were located close enough to the Disney parks and all of the things to see and do there, that we would come visit them a lot. And we did. We became pass holders, and we were able to go to the parks many times. So I've probably been to the Magic Kingdom 100 times, you know, at this point.
Fair to say you love it as an adult, not just as a place to take your kids?
I do. Less and less do I go because there's a ride or a particular thing that I'm really eager to do. I think I just have that, it's the draw of nostalgia that brings me back there and helps me experience all over again things that that meant so much to me when I was a boy. And so I feel like I can get a little bit of that back.
Mark Williams is a theater professor at the University of Mary Washington. Think about your last vacation. Why'd you want to go there? Was it recommendations from friends? Maybe an Instagram reel that looked good? Maybe you felt pressured because so many of your friends had gone before. My next guest, Anita Zatori, says young people are choosing vacation places based on memes. Not so much to be there, but to create digital content about themselves being there. It's called meme tourism. Anita Zatori is a professor of tourism and special events at Radford University. Anita, tell me about meme tourism. Are people actually traveling because they've seen a picture that was hilarious or moving and they're going to that site just to experience it for themselves?
Yeah. It also might be that, for example, we are already in New York and then we go to locations to recreate a meme.
Give me an example in New York City of a place like that where people are flocking because of a meme.
Yeah, or they're already in New York and they say like, okay, since I'm already here and I just watched, let's say, the Joker movie recently and I know this meme on a staircase in Bronx, there is this very famous site where actually people flooded the staircase back in 2019 to recreate the meme on the Joker stairs. There's a hashtag Joker stairs. So if you look it up, you will find actually thousands of memes created shortly after the movie came out.
I can see how fun that would be. I would want to do that. Go to the stairs and sort of act like the Joker from the trailer in the movie.
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly what happened. And, you know, there are always different memes trending. Many of these memes are created by movies, but some are created by peers, like other bloggers, and they become popular, very viral. And then people start using it as an instant template that they try to recreate.
What are some other of the big meme tourism sites in the U.S.?
Well, the other very infamous one is the Area 51. And this was more of an event that became really viral. So as we all know, Area 51, it's a military site. It's really guarded. Somehow it came up. So a Facebook event was established called Storm Area 51. They can't stop all of us. This was officially the name of the event on Facebook. I don't know. It became really viral. And over 2 million people RSVP'd that they're going to attend this event and storm the military airbase. So it created a lot of attention.
But the interest in the area was because they thought aliens or UFOs were there?
Yeah, and it kind of became a meme. So this is, for example, a type of event where there was no movie, you know, just the legend, just the rumor about UFOs and so on. Someone created this event and it became extremely viral. It really created a lot of attention since there were like 2 million people who RSVP'd that they're going to participate. And, you know, the Air Force had to address it and saying like, hey, please don't do it, you know, because yes, it is a top secret, you know, military airbase. You know, we're going to protect it. So actually what happened at the end is that only 10,000 people showed up and it turned into a festival type of event between people. We were all interested in the secrets of Area 51.
There was another meme that I thought was great, and this was the West Maple Omaha Rock. Tell us what the West Maple Omaha Rock was and why people thought it was a hoot to go there and have their picture taken.
This was basically just a parking lot median. It's not known who started it, but it really gained attention after some drivers kept getting their cars stuck on the top of it. So, and then it became like a photo theme, and more people tried to do that, or even just sit on the top as mermaids. Right. Yeah.
And did it bring an inordinate number of people there, like more than a handful?
Well, there was, again, a Facebook page, which was called the W Maple Omaha Rock. And in a couple of weeks, it already had 20,000 members. We are not sure how many people actually visited the rock or from how far they came to visit the rock. But there was a huge interest. You know, it really got viral attention.
You actually visited Dubrovnik in Croatia, where mm-hmm. the King's Landing was filmed in the Game of Thrones series. Did you go there for that?
Yes and no. So I was already in Split, Croatia. It's not far away. Dubrovnik is just a little bit more south from Split. But it's a beautiful city in itself with a lot of World Heritage sites. But yeah, certainly King's Landing was there. I knew about it when I visited the Dubrovnik.
Was that fun for you?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you don't want to miss it while you are visiting, right? In the castle, on the site itself, they recognize the Game of Thrones movie, and they have a throne, or the copy of the throne that was in the movie. You know, you can sit on the throne and take a picture on the throne and so on. So they absolutely use this for their advantage. I imagine that many people decide to visit Dubrovnik because it was King's Landing in the Game of Thrones show.
So you are looking at the power of memes to draw people to sites. How much is social media impacting where people decide to go and how they experience those places?
I would say social media, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook have really very powerful impact on our decisions. Decades ago, right, when we only had TV or magazines that inspired us. Now, most of these resources are taken over by social media. Whether we are talking about millennials or Gen Z or baby boomers, everyone is a social media consumer nowadays. So we try to recreate pictures what we see on social media.
So what are you learning from your own students? What sort of social media are they mostly influenced by?
They mostly use TikTok. That's their platform. As millennials is more about Instagram, Gen Z is more about TikTok. Facebook is, as they call it, is rather for old people.
Right. What are they talking to you about experiencing on TikTok that's really appealing to them?
They follow bloggers, travelers, and they're amazed that, yes, this is actually a profession. Like, you can become a travel blogger, and actually you can live from being a travel blogger. Meanwhile, you know, you are also visiting these amazing sites and staying at a resort. It's actually really attractive for them, and it is an absolutely possible career option for them.
Do you think more tourism destinations should be tapping into young talent like that and promoting themselves through travel bloggers?
It depends who is their target market. I think that there is a great shift towards social media. And definitely if you would like to get millennials under 45, will be social media.
What advice could you have for a small community or one business area that has the potential to attract young travelers like this? What advice would you have for how they even get started to buy social media influencers?
Every social media influencer, they have very good data about where their followers are coming from. 100,000 of people or 10,000 of people or million of followers. Where are they from? Information about their demographics and so on. The social media sites provide this data to the influencers. Knowing that, they can communicate it to the destination organizations. Are those the followers you would like to see to visit your destination?
Sometimes, apparently, you can get too much of a good thing. And that happened, for instance, to a really popular beach that people flock to in Thailand. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, so that was the Phi Beach in Thailand. And it really became popular after the movie with Leonardo DiCaprio, The Beach, was a location for that movie. And unfortunately, it became really polluted and they had to shut it down.
Be careful what you wish for, right?
Yeah. But it was actually really interesting that even before they started shooting the movie at this location, they improved the sand on the beach to make the water seem like bluer, to make it like prettier. If you look at the trending content, whether on TikTok or Instagram, there are certain formulas for reels and for pictures, like what makes it trendy and popular. So many of the bloggers and influencers, and even us who are not influencers, just follow that certain formula to make pictures viral, appealing, and trendy. It's same as, you know, fashion. For me, it's a little bit disappointing to see that this impact of social media, and when we travel and the type of the pictures we take or the sites that we visit are also pretty much impacted by these formulas, by this instant content.
What is the formula, by the way?
It's always different. You know, the formula in case of the pink wall is the pink wall itself. That's the formula. Nowadays, I'm really amazed by all the reels on TikTok, how it becomes popular, just like peeking into your life. Like, this is how I start my morning having a newborn twins and like peeking into her everyday life. There are like so many of these type of reels recently.
So the very ordinary can become wildly popular. What's wrong with that?
That itself wouldn't be anything bad. I'm just saying that there's certain trends where it's not about our intrinsic experience, but rather how we express those experiences. And how we express that experience is many times standardized because we try to create this instant content that's trendy.
I totally see that. I think that's very wise. Anita Zatori, thank you for sharing your insights on With Good Reason.
Thank you so much.
Anita Zatori is a professor of tourism and special events at Radford University. This year's Festival of the Book presents Wine and Words with best-selling author Jamie Attenberg. This literary happy hour celebrates Attenberg's new book, 1,000 Words, a book about becoming and staying motivated, whether you're a writer or anyone in search of a creative spark. For tickets, go to vabook.org. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason from Virginia Humanities. My next guest is a global tourism expert, from creating homestays in Bangkok to operating a restaurant in Sydney, Australia. Cherry Brewer knows how to create an experience. Cherry Brewer is the first professor of hospitality and tourism at the University of Virginia's College at Wise. Cherry, I love how your own life experience has informed your role as a hospitality and tourism professor. You began with an art history degree in your homeland of Thailand, and that came in handy when you were young and leading tours of Bangkok.
Yes. Yeah, so my first tour, I still remember that I was shaken. And at that time, I spoke broken English. And then I still remember that the first amount of money I made was about like 300 baht, which is $10 for one day. Yeah, but it was a fun experience. I remember there was like about five tourists and they are from Brazil. They nod and smile. And I don't know that they really understand me, but they didn't say anything.
How old were you?
I was, I think, 22 at that time.
Where were you taking them? Only to temples, or did you do a lot more with them?
Oh, that was a big temple. It's called the Grand Palace. And then it's close by, like, the palace of the king in the past. So that was the only place that I took them. But it's a big place, so you can spend, like, the whole day in that area.
You later worked in the hotel industry near Disneyland Paris, where every weekend you traveled by train to different European countries. That must have been such a thrilling experience.
Yes. So at that time, I took an internship in the hotels near Paris. And, you know, Paris is always just like in my dream destination to go. And then during the weekend, I took a train. It was like a train that connect with the subway. It's about 20 minutes from where I live to the Paris. And I still remember the first time I saw the Eiffel Tower, I just screamed by myself. Like, I was just like, oh my God, I'm here. But I was alone. So scream, oh, I'm here. Finally, I make it to the Eiffel.
When you were taking those trains to various European countries on the weekends, were you alone? Were you a solo woman traveler?
Yeah, I was alone. I was alone and I traveled not only in Paris. I went to like nearby country by myself and it was solo trips. And I still remember once I went to Monaco and it was in during the F1 racing, the Formula One Grand Prix. And because I was a student at that time, I don't have money to pay for the hotel. There was one night that I sleep on the street. Yeah, but I was like, it was the night before the final round. So people party all night and then I sleep on the bench and that was a Ferrari parked next to me. So I'm just like, okay, if anyone gonna rob me, they're gonna rob the Ferrari first. So that was that was my thought. So I was just like, I will be safe.
Where else did you go?
Yeah, I went to Monaco. I went to Belgium, Switzerland. Also, I went to Germany, like anywhere that nearby. I live in Paris for about like 6 months. So every weekend, I would just go out of the country or maybe go to other cities nearby by train.
You once traveled to London just to eat a roasted duck dish that you'd heard about. Tell me about that.
Oh, yeah. So when I was an intern in a hotel in Paris, I only have 2 days off every week. And there was one day that I traveled to London. It's about like 3 hours by train. And at that time, I was craved for Asian food. And I know that in London, there's a restaurant, Chinese restaurant, that sells roast duck. And it's very famous among Thai people. The restaurant is called Four Seasons. And then I get on a train. I have about 200 pounds in my pocket. And then because the train across from Paris to London is pretty expensive, so I went by bus. And then when I crossed the border, there was a police came into the bus, and then he just checked my passport. And then because I was alone, I'm a woman, and it was at night, they kind of suspect whether I'm like an illegal tourist or someone that tried to go across the border. So they asked me, what are you going to do in London? I said, I'm going to travel. And where's your camera? And I'm just like, here's my camera. And you only have this money. They even checked my wallet. And I was just, yes, because I only plan to go eat the duck and come back to Paris tomorrow. And they just laugh and they let me go. Yeah.
And yes. You can't make that story up.
Yeah, no, because I really intend to go eat the duck and then come back. And they were just like,
did you eat duck?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I ate the duck. And just two years ago, I just went back to London again and I'm just went to the same restaurant by that roast duck. And I took a picture, post on my Facebook and just told my friend that here I come again, eat that duck that is was in my memory when I was poor and just want to travel to eat the duck and almost be captured by the police.
At some point, you went to Australia and you helped your sister run a Thai restaurant that she owned there. I know you did a lot. You worked the books in the back. You helped with customers. You probably even learned to make some really terrific Thai dishes.
Yes. So that was when I graduated from the college. And then, I worked as the tour guide for a while. I worked at the art gallery for a while. And I feel like, I want to learn English. And by that time, my sister opened a Thai restaurant in Australia, in Sydney. So I'm just like, maybe this is a good opportunity to learn English and also be independent and stay away from the family. And yes, I learned to cook for the first time. So my family are very good cook, my sister and my mom. So I not really have to cook when I was home. But when I have to live abroad, I start learn how to cook. And then, after that, I just really enjoy cooking.
Are there some Thai dishes that have become your specialty that you like to make for friends, family?
Oh, yeah. I think that probably some green curry chicken, all types of curry. When I went to America, I studied a PhD in hospitality and tourism at University of Tennessee, Knoxville. And they have Ready to the World Cafe. And they saw me that, you are Thai. Why don't you be a guest chef? Yeah, and I cooked that curry and served the Knoxville residents.
What else?
Penang curry and also some papaya salad. So the dessert, I like to cook mango sticky rice. And also, I used to make some coconut ice cream.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah.
And did they enjoy it?
Oh, yeah. And the ticket always sold out. So it's something that I was very proud that I always told them I'm not a professional chef, but I just someone that I like to cook. And I'm happy if you enjoy my food.
Now you're a professor of hospitality at a college in Appalachia, which is also, like where you're from in Thailand, rich in agriculture and very beautiful. Can you describe where you live and the natural resources you see there?
Yes. So I think this area has a very beautiful nature, a lot of big mountains, which a lot of unexplored, unspoiled nature. Especially when the season change, you can see during winter, you can see snow on the mountain. During spring, you see all the greenery of the leaf in the forest. And then in fall, you see the color change. And it's really beautiful. There's a lot of places that you can hide. And sometimes I feel straight. Of course, we have a bad day. I just go into the mountain and we can go. There was a place called the Hai Nop. We just go up there and drive up there. And then you can see four different states that surround here, Virginia, Tennessee, and Kentucky, and North Carolina. And it's picturesque and it's really beautiful.
And yet so beautiful, but not much tourism, so, right?
It's tourism, but it's not crowded tourism because of the population in this area is not high. Compared to another size of the Appalachian, like a nearby tourist attraction like Smoky Mountain. This area is pretty rural, and we have some tourists, but not crowded.
So into this bucolic scene is soon to come a large casino, I understand, right? Mm-hmm, maybe not in the farm area, but in the nearby city of Bristol.
Yes. So Bristol is about 1 hour from where my university is located. And the other name for Bristol they call is Music City.
Music City is where country music was born, they say.
Yeah. So Bristol has always been a city that have a cool clubs and concerts around that area. And now with the casinos building and they expect to fully operate in this fall. So I just pretty sure that there will be more concerts and more tourists coming to this town.
You're getting an online gaming management certificate for the first time ever from a university in Las Vegas. So you should be a hot commodity.
So the thing is, the university that I'm working right now, we are opening the hospitality and tourism management program. And because of casino opening, we expect that tourism in this area will be booming. And since tourists going to come, of course, we prepare. We as the educational institute, we have to prepare labor to work in the industry. So I'm just like, since casino is something that I'm not familiar with, so I'm just taking an online class.
Have you ever gambled at a casino?
Yeah. If I recall, I think I spent about like $10. That's the maximum.
A day's wages when you were giving tours of Bangkok.
Well, in Thailand, we not allow casino. And right. Also, I'm not really do gambling, but I kind of like want to know how to make money from this business. So that's why I'm taking the class and I'm just like try to apply this course, what I learned from this course, to share it with my student in the future, because I think this is they have a lot of career opportunity for students to explore. And it's not that casino operation is something that always bad. They do a lot of social responsibility campaign. They do a lot of donations for education and for community. So I think this is something that I think is excited for Virginian residents, for all the opportunity to coming.
Huge numbers of jobs, do you think?
Yeah. Because right now, as far as I know, there are like 5 towns in Virginia, 5 cities that are allowed to operate the casino. The one in Bristol is the only one in the 5 cities. And right now, even they're still under construction, they already hire 600 people. And once they fully operate, they will hire like 1,000 people.
Cherry Brewer, this has been so much fun talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Cherry Brewer is a professor of hospitality and tourism at the University of Virginia's College at Wise. In graduate school, my next guest was backpacking through Europe with classmates when a conductor singled her out. "Where's your train ticket?" he wondered. But he didn't ask anyone else in the group that she was traveling with. That led her to wonder about the experiences of women traveling solo. Chenille Bernard Thompson is now a professor of hospitality and tourism at Virginia Tech. Chenille, you were backpacking with classmates in Europe when something happened to you that led to a deep curiosity about solo women travelers. Tell me about that.
Sure. So I was on a train. We went backpacking through Europe. As I said, we went to all the major cities. I felt like it was when we were on a train from Germany going either to Austria or some place in between. I had a unique encounter with the train conductor. He would come in, and even though he didn't always check everyone's ticket, he asked for mine when I was with a group of, white students. And he didn't single me out or anything, but it just made me more aware of having my documents ready and staying close to the group, And that's actually how the idea of the research project came about, because I was talking with my Bangladesh professor, and he talked about, he as a male experienced the same things when he traveled to different places because he enjoys traveling. But that led me personally to wonder about the experience of women traveling alone to unfamiliar places where the locals don't look like them.
You actually found about 300 Facebook Bangladeshi travel group. Mm-hmm. What sorts of things did they share with one another about traveling as primarily Muslim Bangladeshi women?
Yes. So it felt like an online safe community space where I feel like these women were using like an alternative medium to not only connect with each other, but to, share information about places that they felt safe, so to speak. Because by doing this research, I got some more information about the challenges Bangladeshi women would face when they even use a regular transport system back home, even before they go internationally. They have barriers related to their own transportation system, how women are not, some women are not even allowed to travel without another male's presence, and how that is actually discouraged by their family members. So yes, it would be just them sharing about their experiences at a particular destination, the food they ate, you know, just the regular social media things to have other people commenting and asking about the experience.
You also wrote that Muslim women traveling alone often feel obliged to comply with Islamic dress codes or only go to places with halal food and prayer room spaces. Mm-hmm. Is this different from what their male counterparts experience, do you think?
As a caveat, I did not study the male experiences. It was more like from an informal discussion with my professor, who is from Bangladesh. And he would often say that on one hand, he would be labeled as coming from another country that already, you know, there's a global perception of people from the Middle East. So he would either be labeled as Iranian or be looked at a certain way because of, you know, obviously he has dark hair, and it becomes challenging for people, for Western people, to really make disassociations from where the country of origin people are from. So with that, he has experienced stares. He has experienced extra checks like what I went through when I was traveling on the train. But all of those experiences did not deter him from traveling. It just made him more aware.
Yes, yes. And then you think, from what you could gather, you found that women face even extra constraints just because of the societal norms that they are immersed in mm-hmm. in their home country.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so basically the women accept this inequality in the society based on the fact that more positions of power should be held by males, right? And they also accept their traditional gender roles, right? Because as a woman, you are expected to stay home and take care of your family, not necessarily get an education or live on your own or travel, right? So these are just some common societal norms, I would say, that would affect the person's ability to travel in the first place.
When you look at the travel industry itself, do you think that there are things that the industry can do to make travel more fun and more convenient and better, especially for Middle Eastern women traveling alone or Muslim women traveling alone? How can the industry be responsive to what they need?
Yes. So the industry can be responsive to their needs by recognizing that these are individuals who also want to enjoy life. And so they have to develop the infrastructure to make them feel safe when they want to travel.
Do you know of some destinations in the U.S. that have done a particularly good job of this?
If I know of any, unfortunately not. I've not gone so deep into options over here.
How would you say your own experience working in tourism and hospitality, as you supported yourself through school, affected your desire to pursue it later, now?
Okay, so I think it's a combination of reasons or elements that have actually guided my passion for this industry now. So first, again, it was the concept of hospitality was initiated through my encounter with my boss in college. While working in the industry as a college student, I just became aware even more and more that I really enjoy connecting with people. I enjoy serving. And, you know, oftentimes in hospitality, you would do work that don't get recognition, but it is so important to the overall service quality of the organization that you're working in. For example, in housekeeping, nobody sees you. But at the end of the day, if that room is not clean to the best of the ability, or if that room is not spotless, then, you know, the hotel will get a very bad evaluation. So although they don't see you, you realize that that is a very important element of it.
I totally agree with you about that. And when I'm in a hotel, I think, I don't want to use all the trash cans because I don't want someone to have to empty them all. Or, you know, small things like that when you're thinking of the people behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
I used to work in a restaurant, and when I would take the dirty dishes away and put them into the bin filled with water for the dishwasher,
mm-hmm.
I would scrape them first so there was less food to go into the dishwashing
mm-hmm.
bin.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the dishwashers looked up with joy and said, "Yes."
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
You know, each of us should look out for the other.
Yes. And just to kind of go back to your question that you asked earlier about why we should care, because when we travel to another place, we are that tourist. We are that person that looks different from us. And wouldn't we want somebody or that area to provide services that that are important to us? If we start putting ourselves in the other person's shoes, I feel like it will really widen our eyes on how we really need to not just think about ourselves, but think about how it will affect other people.
Do unto others as you would like done unto you.
Yes.
Chenille, this has been wonderful. Thank you for talking with me on With Good Reason.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Chenille Bernard Thompson is a professor of hospitality and tourism at Virginia Tech. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. This year's Virginia Festival of the Book presents Wine and Words with best-selling author Jamie Attenberg. This literary happy hour celebrates Attenberg's new book, 1,000 Words. It's a book about becoming and staying motivated, whether you're a practiced writer or someone in search of a creative spark. For tickets and more on the book festival, which runs March 20th through 24th, go to vabook.org. With Good Reason's production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Aviva Costo and Andrew Rice are our interns. Special thanks to Jenny Taylor for booking assistance. For the podcast or to comment, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.